Accession number 28495, reel number 3.
Oh, here's reel 3.
Sorry?
Did you see anything of Alan Cobham's Flying Circus at all?
I did, yes. He came to a field half a mile away from where I lived, large field. And we went on to watch this, and it was absolutely superb. I couldn't afford whatever it was for a little flight, but I had a great deal of pleasure in watching, and especially, for example, when they'd have attach a little spike to one of the wings, and the pilot would come down and pick up a handkerchief attached to a little stick. It's quite good precision flying. And really exciting, of course. We're very pleased to see that. Yes. Yes.
Obviously, as we said earlier, you were working at the Poison Gas Factory.
Yes.
The war had started.
Yes.
Did you feel that you would be involved in the war in more than sort of obviously the civilian employment?
No. Working when the war started. I very quickly began to feel I wasn't doing anything useful. I didn't think they had anything really to learn from making mustard gas. It didn't matter whether it was pure or not pure, or whether the yields were high or not. They could make tonnage quantities of mustard gas without employing us. I have a feeling that there must have been an awful lot of wasted effort there. And certainly we got very dissatisfied and feeling that we were wasting time, especially through this time like the Battle of Britain, for example. We just thought we should be doing something better than this. Now, this was mainly the people who wanted to go in the forces. I can't speak for the others. I think they were probably glad to be in a reserved occupation.
Were you a member of the Air Cadets?
No.
But you went to the Air Cadets to learn navigation?
I went to their lectures. I was a little older for them, you see, because I was in my, about coming up to 1920, whereas they would be 14, 15. So I was certainly welcome at the lectures, and I benefited from them, especially on things like navigation. But because of our background in studying science, studying the subjects for the RAF wasn't a difficult matter to do. Yes.
The level of navigation that you were listening to in lectures there, was that relatively easy to understand then?
Of course, but later on when we got on to initial training, I had no trouble in keeping up with the training on navigation, signals, Morse code and other things. The other thing I did, when Anthony Eden broadcast an appeal for people to join as volunteers, to join the local defence volunteer, I went and joined. And I was serving with them for quite some time until I was getting to the stage where I was thinking of going to the RAF, and I thought, well, the one thing I want to learn is Morse code. So I left, before this, I decided that the Air Raid Warden Service was doing a more useful work than the LDV, Local Defence Volunteer. So I became an Air Raid Warden for a time and did regular Air Raid Warden duties. My father, because of his position on the council, he was the senior warden, and he was also the senior person in civil defence. Had there been, an emergency, he would have been the senior civilian person in the town, liaison with the military authority.
Can I ask you a little bit then about the Home Guard before we move on? You joined quite early on, had you?
Yes.
The appeal went on in June 1940.
It hadn't been started as the Home Guard. It was still Local Defence Volunteers. We wore an armband, LDV. And we were issued with rifles which came out of museums. Some of them had seen the Boer War. And we were marching around with these. Sometimes there'd be a roadblock set up. And we would be stopping vehicles. It was just training. And we stopped vehicles to inspect them. But we didn't have any... the guns were not serviceable. We didn't have the ammunition. But while I was still there, we were supplied with ammunition and we were getting in the Lee Enfield. And then we had to be careful because some of these younger people were dreadfully careless. You had to watch them. And on one occasion, I was called out about 10 o'clock at night, and it was something like November, pouring with rain, black as anything, and had no light on the bike, and I cycled a short distance, and an air raid warden bellowed at me. No, I had the light on the bike. An air raid warden bellowed at me to turn that light off. So I turned the light off, and another 100 yards, and somebody bellowed at me to turn the light on. Well, it was complete class. They were stupid. And we had to go out and defend a bridge, which went to a coal mine, just a little bridge, and we sat there all night trying to keep sheltered. And in the morning, I had to say to the officer of the English Army, I said, "You better let me go now. I've got to go to work. I've got a 12-hour shift coming up. I must be cast." So I had to go into work.
Where did you meet with the Home Guard? Where did you meet when you were in the Home Guard?
In our area of Sutton, they'd taken over quite a large estate, walled estate, which had belonged to Colonel Michael Hughes, with quite a large mansion. This had been empty, so the Air Force, the Home Guard had taken this over. We had our meetings there, and we did training in the ground.
What type of training did you do at the start? What was the very kind of basic training you did with the Home Guard?
Very, very little indeed. I do remember the first time we were called on to go to this meeting, and a regular army officer, very smart chap, obviously well educated, gave us a talk on the importance of what we're about to do, in which he quoted the business of the Pass of Thermopylae and the Greeks defending against the Persians. I remember that. They were fairly serious about it, but there was a long time before, for example, we could fire anything. I soon left to go into the Air Raid Wardens, but then realising I wanted to go into the Air Force, I then transferred back into the Home Guard, which was now based on the factory. I went there because they had a man there, expert on Morse code, and he was teaching me Morse code, and I joined the signal section.
But in those early days, if I can take you back slightly to when you first joined, what was the kind of composition of the men in the unit in the Home Guard?
I can't remember there being a large number. I think you say we're pretty well all privates to begin with a smattering of older people, officers. I can remember very little about it. In fact, I don't think we even got uniforms up to the time I left. We were still Local Defence Volunteers with just the armband. And a lot of enthusiasm and not much else.
What did the training consist of? Was there a lot of drill?
No. We never had any formal drill that I can remember. And even when I joined the factory-based Home Guard unit, we'd have a parade, but we didn't drill in the sense of marching backwards and forwards. The most useful thing we would do would be to have field exercises. And on one occasion we had a big exercise liaising with the Army and the Air Force. So because I was now in the signal section, and the factory was our base, so we ran out telephone lines to sort of a barn here, a farmyard there or something else, and I got myself into a barn with a lot of nice dry straw to sleep in with a phone, and I was in communication there. And this went on over the weekend. That was quite interesting. But I remember on one occasion, because I had learned a semaphore, and I was ordered to climb onto a railway embankment to start semaphoring signals. And I went up and looked at this man and thought, before I got the first letter out, I should be a dead man, shouldn't I? Anyway, I did the semaphoring, but I didn't think much of the officer.
How big was the signal section?
Sorry?
How big was the signal section?
Oh, myself and the older man who was training me. But, of course, in a situation like this, we put somebody on a telephone at each end.
By the time you'd gone back to the factory, was the Home Guard much better equipped?
Yes, we were. We now had Lee Enfields and ammunition, tin hats. I don't remember if we had uniforms. We may have done. One member, a friend of mine, slightly senior, with a degree in chemistry. We were on parade one time, and this idiot with a loaded rifle lifted it to his shoulder and aimed it at the officer. I couldn't believe my eyes. I knocked it out of his hand. I just grabbed it, nearly hit him with it. I was astonished that you could be so stupid. We had a lot to learn.
Did you have any weapons training at all?
Any?
Any weapons training?
No. Friends who'd stayed in the outside Home Guard, based on this Colonel Michael Hughes hall at Sutton, they had training including using sticky bombs on tanks. Not an exercise I wanted to do, but they told me about this.
And you'd left the Home Guard to join the IRP. Was that once the bombing had started?
Yes. Because Liverpool was being bombed. And we had a few bombs around St Helens, and I felt that was a more useful activity. But of course, at this time, I was very often doing 12-hour night shifts. I would sometimes come home 10 o'clock in the evening, have an enormous meal, and go onto an air raid warden duty for an hour or two then before going home to get some sleep.
But what would your duties entail as an air raid warden?
We had a small building, a brick building, which was our headquarters, just room for a sort of sit, toilet, wash bin, and place for make tea, and the phone, of course. We would then be sent out by a senior warden on patrols, looking for people with lights showing, anything like that. And in the case of an air raid, we could go out, usually with a tin hat, of course, and see if there was any damage. Fortunately, we had very, very little damage where we were, very rarely. I know I've been in bed once, heard a bomb whistling down, and I couldn't be bothered to get out of bed because I thought it was going to be too late anyway.
Were there people who you'd see who would be sort of persistent offenders with, like, the blackout curtains? Would it be a problem?
No. The blackout was pretty good. It was pretty good. But right at the beginning of the war, and before I joined any organisation, there was an air raid warning, which was almost certainly a false alarm, a fault, and the air raid wardens round about were running up and down the street, sheerly panicking, telling people to switch off lights, and it was just panic. They had a lot to learn.
By the time you were in it, was it quite an organised force?
I think so, yes. And although we were not exposed to the bombing of other areas, the basis of the organisation was there. I mean, had there been any local bombing. We had enough area wardens to sort of do what they could while calling in for help from police, fire or ambulances, that kind of thing. There was a useful basis there.
Did you receive any training with the AFP?
None that I can remember, no. It's just word of mouth. And you would go out with an older man and pick it up from them. I don't remember any lectures. Lots of literature being given out, of course, yeah.
It must have been quite a tiring exercise to do ARP duties and the 12-hour shifts at the factory.
Yes.
How did you? I mean, obviously you were young at the time, but was it very fatiguing?
It was fatiguing, and there were times when you could hardly stay awake at work, especially night shift. After a time, I think the factory realised that 12-hour night shifts were not productive, and they dropped it. We went on to an 8-hour shift system. Well, having dropped from 12 to 8 hours, I could do an 8-hour night shift and nowadays fishing and get enough sleep. it was a sheer luxury then, because of course we had some marvellous weather then through 1940-41. There's some wonderful weather.
So at that period, you'd rejoined the Home Guard to learn some Morse code. You had an interest in aviation. You'd had some experience with the Home Guard as well. How did you go about joining the RAF?
Well, I had volunteered some time earlier, and I estimate that being in the poison gas factory probably delayed me by at least 2 years of going in. So I went in September 1942. My service number was 1684443, and the rank was AC2, aircraftman second class.
How had you gone about volunteering?
I don't remember. I think I must have gone down to Liverpool to the recruitment centre and told them I wanted to join. And I certainly had a medical there shortly afterwards.
And when you'd been selected, was there any kind of interview process?
Oh, yes. I was called to Padgate, which is just outside Warrington, about 8 miles from home, for this aircrew selection. And I had always reservations about my physical fitness, my mental fitness, and so on. I remember some aspects of the interview which seemed to go fairly smoothly, and they asked me questions like, if you're bombing a city, what would you be reaction, your bombs on people? And I said, well, it's got to be done, kind of thing. Whatever, I was past fit physically and psychologically, and told I would be accepted for pilot training. Well, that night, of course, I was, on cloud nine, if you like, and I went into the Naffy in the evening, full of smoke for a drink, and they played a song, Ride, Cossack, Ride. Do you know it? Well, the essence of the story is, Ride, Cossack, Ride, love is waiting. Well, in the noise and so on, I got the opposite. Ride, Cossack, Ride, love is not for you, kind of thing. Well, it was only a tiny incident, but it fitted in with my psychology anyway. The fact was that training to be a pilot is a full-time job. You've no time for romantic associations, and I treated it that way. It was a long time before I began to learn that a pilot is most eligible because it was one way to get a widow's pension. I didn't think that way. And so I went through the war on the lines of, this has got to be, full time. I had lots of friends, and I met one or two nice young ladies. But I think the modern day people would be amazed how many people came out of the war as virgins. They wouldn't believe it.
Once you'd been accepted, did you go down to the aircrew reception centre at St John's Wood? Did they send you down?
In London, yes. This was some time. There's quite a, I can't remember when I had the interview and the medical test, but there's quite a long wait before I was called down to London to St John's Wood. It was actually, as I said, 9th September 1942. I got my inoculations on the 30th of September. That was my 21st birthday. We all took off our clothes in the back street and went up an iron staircase of these big flats, arms like this, through a door, and you were attacked. And within 5 seconds, you got 5 inoculations, and a few fell over. I thought, well, that's okay, I'm all right. And that night, I ran a temperature of probably about 103, and I felt bloody awful. And I told one of my roommates, I said, look, go down, report I'm ill. He came back and said, they've made a note of it, and if you get delirious, we've got to go down and tell them. Of course, I turned my face to the wall and resigned myself to die. And the next day, I was fit as a fiddle.
How had you been met when you'd arrived at St John's Wood?
Well, we went down individually with a suitcase, and we had to find our own way to the nominated building in the St John's Wood area. We were very quickly kitted out, and as soon as we got our kit, we had to put all our civilian gear back into the suitcase, tie it up, and send it back home.
What had they kitted you out with? What was it?
Well, complete clothing, 2 pair of boots. I think it was only 1 pair of trousers, 1 jacket, overcoat, steel helmet, gas mask, gas cape, that kind of thing. A rucksack to put it all in, a kit bag to put it all in, and a big backpack to go on the back with the webbing and strapping. And a little side pack. We were convinced that this had been designed to cut off the circulation. It did. It was dreadful until you got used to it.
What about accommodation? What was that like?
It's quite good in the building where we were. Probably you might have 3, 4, or 5 in one big bedroom, but we didn't mind that. And we had to begin to learn how to pack the kit and so on, and when you lay out your bed for daily inspection. That really came later in the year, about November or so, when we went to ITW. That's when the real drill started.
So what was the pattern of training then while you were still at St John's Wood?
In London, it was simply mainly drilling, marching. I can't remember much in the way of lectures. We did have a few, and I think we went once or twice to the zoo, which was nearby, for lectures, and once or twice to Lord's, the cricket ground. But we were only there for a short time, and then in October we went to Ludlow. I don't know if you got that down there. This was a tented place, 3 camps just on the outskirts of Ludlow, all in tents. It's just a way of holding people in a cheap form. We were in bell tents, designed for army 8 people. I think we might have had 6 in ours. It was all field kitchen stuff, gum boots, because it's all muddy, and wearing not our normal uniforms, but some denims we'd been issued with. Every day, 3-ton trucks would go out to chop down wood in the forest nearby to bring the wood back to keep the fires going for cooking. And we were eating under tents and open-air cooking. Practically everybody had tummy upsets and diarrhea. And it was a case of as one lad put it, round tent pole and out through flap. And one night I got up with this problem, and I dashed to the nearest row of latrines at a full moon and freezing, and the seats were icy, and I sat down with great agony. And after a few minutes or two, I looked at the other end. I said, "John, is that you?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How long have you been there?" He said, "I don't know, a long time." He was out of my tent and I'd not missed him. That was what it was like there. And after 3 weeks, we'd not had a bath or a shower. And we were doing hard physical work. A lorry loaded with cement came in. I'll tell you what we're using cement for in a moment. And they asked for volunteers to unload the cement, and nobody moved. It was about 5 o'clock in drizzle, and nobody moved. So the officer said, "Right, if you volunteer, I'll guarantee you'll get a shower." So we got trampled in the rush. So we rushed and we unloaded this. And then he sent us down to camp number 3, where we'd been promised a shower, and the showers weren't working. So they had to give us a 36-hour pass so we could go home to get a shower. And the we were sleeping in these tents, but the cement coming in, we were making breeze blocks to build breeze block buildings. And these were colder than tents because there was a refrigeration action. They were wetter and colder. And people who went into those were likely to catch pneumonia. At the end of the session here, and we knew we were going to be initial training, and we knew that's where the bull started, we now had to get back into our ordinary uniforms and get paraded. And by the time we'd marched off the camp and down to the station, we were all muddy and our buttons hadn't been polished for ages. So we get on the train with muddy boots going up from Ludlow to Scarborough. We got off the train with clean boots, but the wash basins and so on were all blocked on the train. There was a dreadful row. And we thought we were all smart, but we didn't realise what the standard was going to be when we got there.
So how were you received when you arrived at Scarborough?
We were met by one of the officers, not the senior, who was a wing captain, but by a flying officer who became one of the lecturers. And he marched us through the town to one of the hotels at Ludlow, at Scarborough, on the south side of Scarborough, on a high level above the sea. Excellent view. I think the name of the hotel was Astoria. And I got a bedroom on the front with two other friends. And immediately we began to learn what the bull meant. And it really was. But of course, you can always play them at your own game, you think. So we knew the sort of standard and we would beat it. The windows were not supposed to be closed. And there was a 6-inch gap. So we marked this off. 6-inch gap, we called, and that was the Jackson line, Wing Commander Jackson. That was the minimum. And then we marked different stages, so we had it wider and wider, exhibiting our preference. It was Mickey taking became an art. The brass plug was polished and hung up, and we've got a rubber bung, and you know, that kind of thing.
What kind of standards were needed?
Very high. Marching was very rapid marching. I can't remember the speed, but it wasn't 1 a second, I think it was about 120 to the minute, you know, to a second. Very fast. And we used to close up and close up and close up. There was a war between us and the drill sergeants, of course, and we were going to win. But they did teach us a method of synchronised marching. You'd learn a pattern of marching, and he could set you off, and you go through 5 minutes of marching from memory. We enjoyed that. And a spectator used to watch this in amazement.
Did you take to drill easily?
Yes, it had to be done, and it was like everything else. It's better to put your back into it and do it well. That made it easy, but both the drilling and the other physical exercises and the lessons. because I put myself down as a rugby player to help my volunteering and acceptance. I'd not played rugby seriously except kicking the ball around at school. So once we settled down, the physical training instructor called us in. All the rugby players we'd gathered in, he knew perfectly well half of them hadn't played. So we started with the blackboard. And having told us the drill and the rules and so on, we then went out to play. And I was playing second row forward, which my brother played. I began to enjoy rugby. It was really good fun.